though I really don't want to go back to that way again. What are you doing now? Monica said. We need to get into Sagantum orbit, I said. We're so close already that I'd have been sure a month ago that I could do it. That doesn't mean I can now, of course. Being nuts isn't necessarily a good thing. I shut down the high drive. Monica and I both grabbed the couch when we lost the acceleration that mimicked gravity. I'd forgotten to strap in when I entered the hull. The Alfraz inserted into the matrix. Lal awakened and stretched. Captain, he called. You wish that I go out alone? I have rested. Lal, I said. There was a short hop in the telltales. No electrical sensors worked on the hull while we were within the matrix, but hydraulic lines like those of the semaphores communicated with the interior. Seem happy. Also, I seem to have a magical connection with the ship right now, and it tells me that we're on course. I grinned. Lal's expression didn't change. Monica's face became completely blank. So I figure we can both take a break until we extract in what I hope is orbit around Saguntum. Yes, Captain, Lal said, nodding in his bunk. I am glad to remain here. I took off my air suit. When Monica realized what I was doing, she helped me. After a moment, she said, We'll land straight at the haven, then. I shrugged. I'll ask orbital control, I said. I expect they'll put us in the civilian port, yes. I looked at her and added, Or you'll ask orbital control, if you're willing to do the combo honors here like you've done before. I was counting on it, Monica said with a grin. She walked to the other side of the console and took the striker seat. She was cheerful, but there was more in her attitude than I understood. The car's destroyer knew where we were going, I said. If they're here ahead of us, I'll have to play it by ear. Will they shoot at us? Monica said. I shrugged. I don't know, I said. I don't think so, but back in the academy, folks talked like on Karst, they're one stage up from dancing around fires with bones through their noses. It's not like that, really, but I'll be just as glad if we don't find the Medusa in orbit when we arrive. Can you land even if they do shoot? Monica said. That was a good question. If they used a missile, no. A missile would gut us, even if launched from so close that it had only a fraction of its maximum terminal velocity. Aloud, I said, they mount 8 10-centimeter guns. If they're in good condition and well-served, they could certainly blow holes in our hull. I gave her a lopsided smile. It's a Karst ship, I said. Chances are the guns aren't in good condition or well-served. But I'll make the decision based on how I'm feeling if the situation arises. I will make the decision. But let's hope it doesn't come up, all right? Monica swallowed and nodded. The countdown clock winked at me. I said, Prepare to extract. We were back in the sidereal universe, in an elliptical orbit above Saguntum. My body had shrunk for an instant before regaining its normal dimensions. For a moment, I wasn't sure where I was, then all was well again. I engaged the high drive and began braking at 1G. We were currently about 90,000 miles out, but on the descending leg of the lobe. Saguntum Control, Monica called from her side of the console. This is the Alfraz, out of Ben Yusuf, Captain Roylan Olfetri commanding, and First Officer Monica Folliot. We request landing permission for the haven at Saguntum. Further, we request that this transmission be forwarded to the Directorate of Public Safety. Alfraz over. I adjusted the angle of the high drive motors to brake us a hair more effectively without having to increase output. I'd like to have a proper power room readout on the console, but I'd like a lot of things. If the bottle failed now and we turned into a tiny second sun above Saguntum, that was the brakes. Alfraz, this is orbital control, the doorkeeper responded, rather more quickly than I would have expected. Your request is being processed. Say again you're leaving port, over. I set the rig to furl and retract. If the console noted any problems, there'd be time for Lal and me to make a hands-on check before we entered the atmosphere. The display stayed green, though. I'd have liked to brake harder than I was doing, but starting from so far out, 1G would get us in safely. Alfraz, you are cleared to land in the military harbor, Orbital Control said. Repeat, your berth is in the military harbor, not the haven. Acknowledge, please. Over. Monica stood up so that she could look at me directly without the distorting screen of coherent light from my display. I nodded and gave her a V-sign with my two fingers. I didn't know why we were to land in the military harbor rather than the normal civilian one. It could be as simple as the fact that we were coming from a pirate stronghold. Saguntum didn't have a real navy, but the annotated charts noted that there were 6 dart sloops, some of which might be unserviceable. I didn't know what dart sloop meant. Some sort of light warship. Well, that was fine. Acknowledge, Saguntum Control, Monica said calmly. Alfraz will land in the military harbor. Alfraz out. When we proceeded far enough in our orbit, a pulsing point appeared on the visual image of Saguntum, which I kept on the upper right quadrant of my display. It didn't matter at this point. The military harbor was separated by only a mole from the haven, which occupied the remainder of the bay. We would have to be much deeper into our approach before the change of a few hundred yards from the berth I'd chosen for my rough solution made any difference. I keyed in the data which Saguntum had sent along with the image. I'd been letting the console do the landings in the past, and I certainly wasn't going to change now. I got up from the couch and walked to the internal hatch. I'm going to check the fusion bottle, I said. Though if it were anything short of deep into the red, I was going to ride it down. The choice would be to hang in orbit until we could be rescued from the ground. And I just wanted to be home. The needle was still in the yellow, though. I switched to the plasma thrusters before I would have done so normally. We had plenty of reaction mass because we'd made most of the run in a single long stage, and I could actually brake harder with the thrusters than I could with the high drive throttled back so as not to stress the fusion bottle. I was learning things this way that I'd never have known on a well-maintained RCN warship. There was a future for me as a tramp captain on the fringes of human space. We hit the atmosphere without any drama, until we'd bucked and rattled our way down to 10,000 feet. Then the port mainyard carried away, ripped out of its clamps, and I suppose dancing off in our slipstream. It didn't flick back and hit the hull, though, so I didn't care once I was sure that the console was able to handle the asymmetric buffeting. At best, a starship doesn't make many concessions to streamlining, so loss of yard and furled sail was barely noticeable. We passed over the breakwater and approached the icon of our berth on the display. The real-time image was obscured by stream. I hadn't figured out how to correct the altimeter error, which caused the Alfraz to drop like an anvil. But I changed the shutdown sequence from instantaneous to having the nozzle pedals flare in a 30-second sequence. We mushed down, unpleasantly but without jolting. I drew a deep breath. "We're down," I said. My throat was dry, and I wondered how long it had been since I'd eaten. "I apologize for giving you a false name," Monica said. Then the words penetrated. I opened my eyes and looked at her across the console. I'd shut down my display. I was sure people were trying to get a hold of me. They couldn't reach me except through the console until the berth cooled down enough to open the ship, and I wasn't in shape to talk to anybody. "Sorry," I said, trying to figure out what she was talking about. With a hint of irritation, Monica said, "I told you my name was Smith. It's really Folliot." "But it's still Monica," I said. She'd announced herself as Monica Folliot to Orbital Control, now that I thought back. I'd had other things on my mind, like the fusion bottle. "Look, I don't care. We got here. I'm glad I knew Monica Smith, and I wouldn't have made it back without her." I got up from the couch, moving carefully. Law was standing. He looked about 50 years older than he had when we lifted from Ben Yusuf, but I probably looked like my dad, too. Well, Dad had run to fat as he got older, and right now I was more like a coat rack with a set of slops hung over it.
"It's just I didn't know you," Monica said, nodding her fingers together. "I thought you might take advantage of me."
"And do what we hadn't done anyway, with a great deal of mutual pleasure?" I wondered. Aloud, I said, "You didn't know me from Adam," I said. "I'd like to think that my good intentions stood out like a beacon, but you'd had a rough time." I took another deep breath and said, "I think we can open her up now. Let's go do that." The hatch controls were in the hold rather than through the console. The Alfraz gave the impression of having been assembled from bits of 3 or 4 separate vessels. The antennas and yards were sized for something much smaller, which had been a considerable advantage when Lal and I were working her alone. I opened the safety lock, then threw the big lever on the outer bulkhead. The dogs withdrew and the hatch began to rotate down into a boarding ramp. The mix of steam and ozone that curled down as the opening widened made me sneeze. I shut my eyes against the sting. I smelled Saguntum again, its garbage at least, as incinerated in our exhaust. I wondered how Monica was feeling to be home, really home. Her hands were knotted together, her lips were moving in what could have been a prayer. By the time the hatch had lowered below the height of my eyes, the air had cleared enough for me to see that there were scores of people on the quay.
Many of them were uniformed, which wasn't a surprise, but standing in the center of them was a group in ordinary spacer slops. They weren't armed, as some of the uniformed personnel were, but there was a cart with them. When my vision cleared enough to see who the spacers were, I was pretty sure the cart contained weapons. I heard a hoarse order from the key. Too early, I thought. The air and water were both too hot to link to us, but a floating extension bridge began to open toward our outrigger. Instead of yard personnel unrolling it, Dossie and Barnes were doing the job while Wochens walked along behind them as though supervising. The steam still glittered with occasional speckles of plasma. Wochens and her mates gave no sign of noticing it. An air car howled from the city at low altitude, circled out into the harbor in order to line up with the quay, and put down smoothly. The crowd waiting for the hatch to open blocked access from the harbor road, but the end of the quay was empty. A squad in battle dress formed between the remainder of the spectators and the newly arrived vehicle, their weapons ready if not quite pointed. They suddenly fell into formal at-ease posture, with their weapons by their sides in patrol slings. "What in blazes is that all about?" I said. The ramp clanged home on our outrigger at about the same time that the extension from the quay reached it. "That's my father," Monica said. Before I could respond, or stop her, though I'm not sure I would have tried, Monica went running down the ramp and onto the extension. A burly middle-aged civilian had gotten out of the air car and was trotting toward the crowd at the key end of the extension. Wochens and her mates let Monica pass. They parted for Captain Leary, Lady Mundy and their servants, then faced around to stop everyone else. Monica and the civilian met on the key and threw their arms around one another, but I didn't have much attention to spare. "Sir," I said, throwing a salute that did the Academy proud. "Welcome aboard the Alfraz."
Chapter 31. "Good to see you again, Officer Alfetri," Captain Leary said. "May I ask who the..." He gestured behind himself with his thumb. "Attractive blonde who just passed us is?" "Ah, sir," I said. It wasn't as easy a question as it probably seemed. "That's Monica Folliot. Though sometimes she goes by Monica Smith. I'm curious as to how you vanished from Saguntum 3 months ago," said Lady Mundy, "and now have turned up again with the daughter of the Director of Public Safety, who hasn't been heard of since she took ship on Greenwood 6 months ago on her way back to Saguntum." "Ah," I repeated. "Mistress Folliot was imprisoned in the harem of the Admiral of Salaam. I was imprisoned there too when we made our way back to Saguntum. I didn't know who Mistress Folliot was, only that she was a Saguntine citizen and improperly held in Salaam." In the general pause, Leary and Mundy were digesting what I'd said, and I sure didn't have anything more I wanted to say. Lal said, "Captain, what do you wish of me?" Both Captain Leary and I turned, but Lal was talking to me. I'd almost forgotten him. "You're dismissed for the day," I said, "but come back tomorrow morning and we'll see about paying you off." Lal's full wages, and I wanted to add a $50 bonus, would take help from Monica, which I hoped she'd be willing to give. But I had a little cash of my own left. I gave him a $10 coin and said, "This'll get you a room and some entertainment for the night." "A moment, please," Leary said, touching Lal's wrist with his fingertips. Then to me, "Introduce me, please, Alfetri." "Sir," I said, embarrassed. "Captain, this is Lal. He and I worked the ship from Plaque Mines by ourselves." Leary nodded and said, "Lal, are you looking for a berth after you've been paid off?" Lal bowed slightly and said, "Perhaps, Captain." "And talk to my bosun Wochens on your way past," Leary said. "She's the tall one. Tell her from me to assign you a watch tomorrow when you've gotten squared away with your captain here." Lal bowed again, then stuck the coin in his mouth and scampered down to Wochens at the foot of the ramp. Captain Leary gave me a lazy grin. "Any two spacers who can work ship alone for 10 days, he said, "rate able in my book, and I want them in any crew of mine." He exchanged glances with Lady Mundy and said, "Now let's go aboard your Alfraz for a moment and have a discussion about some other things, all right?" "Sir," I said, "yes, sir." I turned to lead Leary and Mundy into the cabin. Hogg and Tovera came along also, as I'm sure everybody but me expected. Well, there was plenty of room in the cabin, though the furnishings were pretty sparse. Wochens looked up from her discussion with Lal and called, "Six, the kid's all right. I'll back whatever you do. You know that, but he's all right." "Understood, bosun," Leary called back.
It didn't change anything, really. I'd from the beginning planned to tell the truth and take what happened. But that exchange showed me that what might happen was even worse than I'd been afraid. "We'll close the internal hatch," Lady Mundy said. "I think the cabin will be as clear of listening devices as anywhere else on Saguntum. Unless you've installed them, Olfetri." "No, ma'am," I said. I knew it was a joke, but I gave an honest answer. I wouldn't know how to. But I used the cameras already installed in the Admiral's palace to connect with Mistress Smith since she didn't have a terminal. I frowned. "Mistress Folliot." Lady Mundy cocked her head as she looked at me. "How did you gain access to the palace computer?" she said. "They put me in charge of it," I said. "Bought me to take charge of it, really. I don't have computer skills, not like we'd mean on Cinnabar, but I had more than they did." I suddenly wondered how the Chamberlain was getting on now that I'd vanished. It could even be that the Admiral had impaled him. Georgios wasn't anything like a friend of mine, but I didn't want that to happen to anybody. And I sure hoped that Abram was doing all right. Captain Leary suddenly laughed and sat down on the couch, rotating it to face into the cabin instead of toward the console display. Lady Mundy sat primly on a bunk, mine as a matter of fact. She'd brought out her personal data unit and no longer seemed to be aware of me. I continued to stand at ease, legs spread slightly and my wrists crossed behind my back. The servants were standing also. Neither of them seemed tense, but that didn't reassure me. "So, Olfetri," Leary said, "start at the beginning." Which beginning? But this was a test as much as it was a question. My choice of where to start told him, and certainly told Lady Mundy, how and how well my mind was organized. "I went to dinner with Mistress Grimaud our first night on Saguntum," I said. "We ate in a restaurant, then went upstairs to her hotel room. I drank too much. She wanted to discuss political things that were none of my business, so I left and went downstairs to the bar." I coughed, wondering if I ought to say the next, because it was embarrassing. If I wonder, then I should. "We weren't intimate," I said. "We didn't have sex." "Why not?" said the captain. One guy to another, I realized. "She wanted me to do things that I wasn't going to do," I said aloud. "I wasn't going to take the price and then stiff her on my part of the bargain. And I guess I was offended that she didn't want to sleep with me. She wanted me to do things for her." "Tell us exactly what Mistress Grimaud said," Lady Mundy said. Her attention was on the display of the data unit, which she controlled with a pair of wands. I took a deep breath, which also gave me a moment to frame the words. "She said you and Captain Leary were dangerous rogues, working for an organization outside the Republic's proper government," I said. I looked at Mundy's data unit because my eyes had to be somewhere. "She said you were on Saguntum to foment a war between Karst and the Republic. She said this would bring on full-out war between Cinnabar and the Alliance, and that this would ruin us." Lady Mundy raised her eyes to me. I met them and said, "Maeve said she was the agent of the Foreign Ministry, trying to prevent the disaster." "What did you think, Olfetri?" the captain said. It was a calm question, the way he might have asked a local for directions in a strange city. "I thought it was above my pay grade, sir," I said, louder than I should have spoken. I was shocked at my own anger. Part of me was screaming, "This isn't fair," as though the universe or the people with me in the cabin cared about that. I thought I'd get even more drunk and forget all about it, but there were two guys in the bar and they doped me and put me on the Martinique, which pirates captured and took to Salam on Ben Yusuf. "From where you escaped," said Lady Mundy to her data unit. She looked up at me and raised an eyebrow. "In a ship which seems to be owned by the hegemony of Karst." "It belonged to the Karst consul at Salam," I said. "He wasn't, well, he was hand in glove with the Admiral. Monica should have been freed. We took the ship, but if Karst wants it back, they're welcome." "What will the consul say if we ask him?" the captain said. I met his eyes and said very deliberately, "Sir, you'd better ask him yourself, if you can find him." Tovera gave a little snicker. Lady Mundy looked at the captain. She said, "I'm satisfied." "Then I am too, and I'll go put Wochin's mind at rest," Captain Leary said. He got up and added, "Olfetri, you can report aboard the Sunray any time you like, but you won't have any duties for 24 hours. I suppose you have things you want to settle here." I started to say that I didn't, but then I thought of something. "Sir," I said, "could I have Chief Pasternak take a look at the fusion bottle here? I don't know who owns the Alfraz, but the bottle needs to be fixed or replaced before she lifts again. And the pump control needed to be repaired, but that's a little thing. For the cost of replacing a fusion bottle, it'd be better business to sell the ship for parts." Larry smiled. I think the chief's been bored with the time we've been sitting in harbor here, he said. He'll jump at the chance. Thank you, sir, I said. I think I'll check in at the Sunray and figure out the next move then. If you're planning to discuss matters with Maeve Grimaud, Alfetri, Lady Mundy said, I'd rather that you didn't. Besides which, the Foreign Ministry delegation has moved into the Counselor's residence to be closer to the seat of government. Ma'am, I said, I really don't want to see the lady again. I suppose she was doing her job, and like I said, that's above my pay grade. But now that I'm back, I just want to be back to normal, where I was before I got shanghaied. Lady Mundy gave me a kind of smile that froze me to the bones. You're right that the matter isn't your business, she said. But it's ours, and we'll deal with it. Unless you be concerned that by speaking you've harmed a woman for whom you clearly feel a gallant concern, don't worry. We were aware of the Foreign Ministry's activities before we lifted from Cinnabar. It's good that you told us yourself, though. This is grown-up rules, kid, Tilvera said. There was a metallic softness in her voice. You get your choice of sides, but you don't get to sit in the middle. I swallowed and nodded to her. Yes, ma'am, I said. I'm on Captain Leary's side. But I wish it wasn't like this. Yeah, said the captain. He suddenly sounded old. I wish it wasn't too. But then I think, if it was the kind of world I wish it was, there wouldn't be any place for me. He looked down at Lady Mundy and added, nor for Adele either. She sniffed without looking up. The universe consists of patterns of information, she said. A good librarian can always find a place to be useful. Lady Mundy lifted her face. It had a terrible stillness, and her eyes were focused on some distant time or thing. Sir, I said, nodding to Captain Leary. I'll be off then. Nobody followed me out of the cabin, at least before I'd gotten to the bottom of the ramp. I guess they wanted to discuss things among themselves. I'd wanted more than anything in life for things to go back to normal, but they hadn't, and I knew they never would for me again. Chapter 32 The crew of the Sunray was happy to see me, remarkably happy. I wasn't sure that anybody would have noticed that I was gone, let alone be pleased that I was back. The thing is, everybody wanted to know what had happened to me. I told them all the same thing. Got drunk, got shanghaied, got captured by pirates, got back. It was all true. My worst enemy couldn't accuse me of drawing the longbow to make myself look good. And if the answer made no bloody sense to the folks asking the question, well, it hadn't made any sense to me when I was doing it. Pasternak was pleased as could be when I asked him about looking over the Afraz. The whole crew, Tex as well as Rickers, was getting antsy. Gamba summed it up with, well, I figure Six and the Mistress are doing some kind of magic like they always do, but it's pretty bloody boring for the rest of us, I can tell you. Pasternak took me from the Sunray to the Afraz in a battery-powered cart that came from the customs service. The transfer, borrowed or bought, must have been above board. The vehicle still had the yellow body color and red stenciled fender and door legends instead of having been repainted. I told Pasternak what the ship was doing, but when we got to the Afraz, I kept out of the way except to lend a hand when requested, lifting clear the cover plate to open up the machinery and similar occasional jobs. He muttered as he looked at things and took readings with a tester from a worn leather sheath. Oh, you're a lucky lad, you are, Pasternak said. I figured he meant me. But he had his nose in his work and may very well have been talking to one of the components he was dealing with. It wasn't a question, so I didn't answer it. And anyway, I didn't disagree. After the better part of an hour, Pasternak rose and faced me. I need to go back to the Sunray now, he said. Yes, sir, I said. I knew he had duties after all. Sir, do you think the bottle can be repaired or should the ship be sold to a wrecker? A wrecker, the chief said in horror. A wrecker! Of course she can be repaired. The circulating passages have to be cleaned, and we'll replace all of the electrical circuitry while we're inside anyway. I'll be back with the crew and the parts within the hour. He turned and gestured to the pump switch. The bulkhead above it was blackened around the point where Lal's wrench had completed the circuit. There the metal was blue in the center, hazing to yellow in a ring beyond. We'll fix that too, but that'll take longer, he added. 3 days, maybe. Chief, I said, are you sure about that? Because the electrician in Plaque Mines did the job in only about 4 hours with a boy to help him. We're not going to bodge the job like that, Pasternak said in disgust. We'll be opening the deck to run the cabling through safely. An air car landed on the quay. The howl sank to a hum as the fans cycled down. I looked out the hatch and saw it looked like the same one Colonel Folliot had arrived in just after we'd landed. That was the only air car I'd seen on Saguntum since the Sunray arrived, so I wasn't surprised when Folliot got out of the passenger compartment. "Now who's that?" Pasternak said, narrowing his eyes. "Friend of yours, lad?" "That's the Director of Public Safety," I said. The chief hadn't been in the party of Sunrays who'd greeted our arrival. "And as for friend, I don't know. I hope at least he isn't my enemy." I remembered my concern about how Monica's parents would feel about their daughter dating a spacer with nothing but his pay to live on. And that was before I knew just who her father was. I also wondered how Monica had described our association. "Well, I'll run back to the Sunray and get things together," Pasternak said. I started to ask him to stay a moment, then decided I wasn't afraid of a man as old as my father. Colonel Folliot could certainly beat the crap out of me if he wanted to. He had 50 pounds on me, and despite his age, was clearly a hard man in all ways. But if that was going to happen, it might as well be now. The chief must have seen something in my face, though, because he said, "Come to think, I'll stay for a little bit." Folliot came to the foot of the ramp. He was wearing a business suit, dark gray with stripes that were white or maybe light blue, to match the tunic under the open jacket. "I've come to see Roylan Olfetri," he called from the quay. "My name's Folliot." "I'm Olfetri," I said. I decided to wait at the top of the ramp, treating this as a visit to the Alfraz, rather than to me specifically. "Welcome aboard, sir." Pasternak looked at me, probably wondering what this was about. I wished I could tell him. "Good to meet you, Olfetri," Folliot said when he reached me. He looked 50 at a distance from the way he moved, but close up I was sure he was older. As we shook hands firmly, he said, "I want to buy your ship." I don't know what I'd expected, but it wasn't that. "Sir," I said, "the Alfraz isn't mine." "It bloody well is," Folliot said. "You captured her from pirates and slavers, didn't you? That gives you title on any civilized planet in the universe." "I think the actual owner was the Karst consul to Salaam," I said. I planned to say something more, but I wasn't sure what. "Monica's told me about the bloody Karst consul to Salaam," Folliot said. "I swear the worst regret I've got in this whole business is that Platt isn't still alive for me to shoot. But with the help of his ship," he nodded generally toward the cargo hold, "which Monica says you fixed so the Salaam defenses won't shoot at, I'm going to take care of a few more of the bastards." A thought struck him. "Say, the ship will work, won't it?" he added. "Monica said there was something wrong with the engines." "The fusion bottle," Pasternak said, startling Folliot and me both. "She'll be up and running by midnight, I figure. The pump switch," he gestured, "that'll take longer to do, right?" Folliot flicked his hands impatiently. "Just jumper it or some bloody thing," he said. "Done pretty doesn't matter." "Done right matters," the chief said, lifting his chin. "It'll be done right, and I'll tell you when it has been." For a moment, I thought Folliot was going to press the matter, but he suddenly relaxed with a grin. "I guess you will at that," he said. "Well, it'll take a couple days to get things together at this end, if I'm honest." "And," I said, "I need to discuss the matter with Captain Leary before I agree to do anything. I guess he's back at the Sunray." "This has nothing to do with Leary or Cinnabar," Folliot said, frowning slightly. "But I can take you over to the Sunray right now if you like." "If it involves me, it involves Cinnabar," I said, "and I'll discuss it with Captain Leary." "Also with Lady Mundy, but I didn't say that." "Colonel," Pasternak said, "if you'll run me back too, I can get started quicker. We'll need the truck to haul the crew and the tools we need." Folliot gave him a little bow. "It will be a pleasure, chief," he said. He led us at a quick pace back to the quay in the air car. Captain Leary was on the Sunray at the command console, like enough, Weddle said. She was one of the pair of spacers on duty in the boarding hold. Their submachine guns hung from a rack discreetly out of sight behind the bulkhead. A watch of some sort on even a trap at anchor was normal, but heavily armed guards would arouse attention. The bridge hatch was open. Captain Leary was indeed at the console. I paused in the hatchway, braced to attention, and said, "Sir, Officer Olfetri reporting to Captain Leary with a visitor." Captain Leary turned and smiled at me. "We're civilians, Olfetri," he said. "I don't think quite so much formality is required," and he was looking past me. "Colonel Folliot, it's a pleasure to see you again. We haven't really had a chance to talk since the Alfraz arrived." "I'll go back to the supplementary station, sir," Lieutenant Enry said, rising from one of the flat plate displays that had been added to the bridge when the Republic rented the Sunray. At any rate, I'd never seen anything like this array on a civilian ship, let alone the supplementary station in the stern. in place of a warship's battle direction center. Yes, I'll hoof it too, volunteered Sun, who'd apparently been doing gunnery practice on another display. That left me and Folliot with Captain Leary and, at another display, Lady Mundy. I'd have asked for her presence if she hadn't been here. Tovera sat on a jump seat, watching impassively. There was a rustle from the corridor, and Hogg entered, squirming between Folliot and the jam. Pull the hatch closed, Colonel, Leary said. Then take a seat and tell us what your proposition is. Look, Leary, Folliot said. I'm not trying to get Cinnabar into this. Some Ben Yusuf pirates captured my daughter. They'd still be holding her now, except your Olfetri here got her loose. I want to go back and teach the bastards a quick lesson, and to do that I want to buy Olfetri's ship, that's all. Larger powers than Saguntum have taught the Ben Yusuf pirates a lesson, Mundy said, focused on Data scrolling through her little personal unit. The pirates are still there. Look, I don't think I'm the Almighty, Folliot said. He seated himself, facing outward from the station Sun had vacated. I'm not planning to wipe out piracy, but I can put pay to the Admiral of Salaam and any pirate ships that happen to be in harbor when we stop by. This boy, he nodded to me, buggered the control circuits of the anti-ship missiles in the harbor when he got out with Monica. I want to use his ship to get back in, land troops, and blow the batteries up for real. Then my sloops can land and do something more, especially at the palace. Sir, I said to the captain. The lockout was general, not just for the Alfraz. Somebody could turn it on as quick as that if they noticed. I think if I'd brought the Alfraz down myself, they wouldn't shoot, though. I cleared my throat and went on. And, sir, I request permission to accompany the expedition. Do you indeed, Captain Leary said. Do you consider this the business of a Cinnabar citizen, Olfetri? Sir, I do, I said. I believe it's the business of any Cinnabar citizen to redress the insult done to a trainee officer of the RCN. Sir. Hogg laughed. I'll bet you can sell that to Navy House, don't you think, Master? He said. I probably could if I thought it necessary to inform anybody at Navy House, the captain said with a smile. At present, I report to Director Jimenez, however, and he has no direct command responsibility over RCN personnel, of course. Any spacers under my command, let's say. Then you'll let Olfetri sell me his ship? Colonel Folliot pressed. I was satisfied myself, but I didn't blame Folliot for wanting it nailed down beyond question. He had to think like the ruler of a planet, which from what Lady Mundy had said, he pretty much was. I think we can do better than that, Colonel, Leary said. The Alfraz should have a proper RCN crew, since she's owned and captained by a Cinnabar citizen. Also, I've spent some time with your Naval Protection Force. You've got good personnel, but sinking ships in harbor will be easier for experienced people, some of which I'd be happy to provide if that meets your approval. Yes, Folliot said. Yes, it certainly does. Then I think we should get to the serious planning, said Captain Leary. Adele, will you please project the maps you've prepared? At the Academy, they talked about Captain Leary as though he were a magician. It wasn't magic, but from what I saw in the next 3 hours, he and Lady Mundy thought way ahead of anybody else I'd ever met. Chapter 33 Freighter Alfraz out of hegemony on Karst, I said, transmitting on what I knew to be the frequency of the harbormaster's office in Salaam. We request permission to land in Salaam Harbor. Over. That's 3 times, Gamba shouted from the striker seat. Even with the thrusters and high drive shut down, a starship's cabin is a noisy environment. How often are you going to call? I guess that'll do, I shouted back. Keying the transmitter again, I said, Freighter Alfraz landing at Salaam Harbor, out. I engaged the landing program, handing all decisions over to the console. We were supposed to be a civilian freighter, and there was nothing about this landing that was likely to be a problem. We were going to land just the way the Alfraz had when it first arrived here, before I stole it, and the way every ship captured by pirates from Salaam had. The high drive kicked in, breaking us out of orbit at about 1.5G. Gamba was watching the fusion bottle from his position. There was now a line feeding data to the console, as there should have been all along. Pasternak was back on the hold with a unit, though. The chief engineer had insisted that he sail with the ship himself, even though Captain Leary had assigned Gamba. It was a thoroughly qualified motorman. Pasternak said he wanted to check the quality of his repairs and modifications, which was probably true, but I'm sure nobody else had doubts. Certainly I didn't. There were 5 riggers, including Lal, on the cabin bunks, and 40 additional couches welded to the deck of the hold. They weren't stacked. Heaven knew that we had plenty of room. The couches were for a company of the special police, the unit which reported directly to Saguntum's director of public safety. Colonel Folliot himself was leading the detachment. The Alfraz dropped into the atmosphere. The plasma thrusters lighted more than a second before the high drive shut off, enough to give us a real kick from the doubled braking. Pasternak will have done something about that before we lift, I'll bet. The exterior sensors hadn't been upgraded, so my view of Ben Youssef was blurry at the beginning, then blocked by a rainbow veil after the thrusters lit. There wasn't much to see anyway, and my attention was on the ship diagnostics. The rigging wasn't rattling to speak of. The Sunray crew had given the Alfraz a quick rebuild at Jackery. Any doubtful clamps and wrappings had been replaced, and what was there now had been snugged up properly. "Prepare for landing," I shouted over the PA system, but nobody aboard could hear me. The Alfraz had been slanting down broadside, driving against the braking effort. As our speed dropped, the console brought our underside parallel to the sea beneath us and slowly rotated our bow forward so that we would appear from the surface to be in normal flight. We were scarcely more streamlined in this attitude than we had been when we started through the atmosphere sideways. Because we had some forward motion, our exhaust was streaming behind us as we approached the roadstead of Salaam. I could see about a dozen ships floating there, most of them cutters of a few hundred tons, like the one which had captured the Martinique. That seemed now to have happened in another lifetime. I picked a fairly empty stretch, more or less in the middle and close to the beach. That was farther than I'd have liked from the pier which the heavier lighters used, but it gave the squads hoofing it to the missile batteries equal distances to go. "Touching down," I said. That was obvious to all the spacers aboard from the doubled sound and queasy mushing, but probably at least some of the troops in the hold had never been off Saguntum. Though if they couldn't hear me, I suppose it didn't matter. The console landed us with less fuss and bucking than if we'd been at a proper dock whose slip walls would set the ripples bouncing back and forth. We were rocking the other ships on the roadstead, but that was their problem. The thrusters shut off. Lal got up from his bunk and did what I hadn't remembered to do, dropped the anchors in both outriggers to hold us in place, barring a serious storm. It was a separate control on the bulkhead. The whole crew was getting up. Wochens helped Lal open a port in the cabin so that he could thrust a flare gun through the influx of steam and ozone. I could barely hear the thump of the flare cartridge since my ears were still stunned from the landing. Lal brought the gun back in, replaced the expended round with a fresh one, and fired again. This time I could just barely make out the pop of the flare bursting above the ship. "What's all that about?" Weddell asked, looking uneasily from Lal to me.
"Mistress," Lal said, "I am summoning boats from the shore. Usually one would come, but because I have summoned two, I hope that we will get many. The boatmen will hope we are coming with many slaves aboard."
"Thanks," Weddell muttered, but she had a sour look. I went into the hold. The police detachment seemed to have come through the landing pretty well, though one or two had tossed their cookies. If you're not used to it, a starship's landing approach is pretty uncomfortable. The troops were pulling on long shawls to cover their battle dress and equipment. The shawls were Ben Youssef countrymen's garb, unusual in Salaam itself, but they wouldn't cause remark. I found Colonel Folliot and said, "Sir, I'm going to open the main hatch shortly. I'd like you to move your people toward the stern, so that they won't be seen from the boats approaching."
"Right," said Folliot crisply.
He reached down for the bullhorn resting at his feet and said, "Squad leaders, get your teams together in the back now. We're going to open the ship up and we don't want to spook our transportation." The troops moved away in good order. I heard a few angry corrections, but there were no major screw-ups and minimal delay. With Folliot at my side, I threw the hatch switch. As the ramp began to crank down, a huge presence joined us. Chief Wochen stood close, wearing a shawl like those covering the troops. Hers appeared to have been cut from tarpaulin. Steam and plasma swirled in. Folliot and many of his people sneezed or coughed. I said, "Chief, you're not going with us. I told you I need you to take charge of the ship while I'm gone and call the sloops down with the rest of the troops."
"Yeah, I thought about that," Wochen said. "Gamba can handle that as well as I could."
"Well, hell, Pasternak's senior, but he doesn't want the job. It's more Gamba's style anyhow." "Chief, it's a Saguntine job," I said. "I'm just along as a guide."
"Six wouldn't want you going alone," Wochen said. "And I won't bloody have it. Just belt up."
"I'm not alone," I said. Folliot was watching us. I couldn't read his expression.
There'll be 40 troops with me. They're with him, Wochen said, nodding toward the colonel. That's as should be. But they're not bloody with you. I am.
I wasn't going to convince her. I just wasn't. Partly, I guess, because she was right.
Glad to have you with us, Chief Wochens, Folliot said. His smile wasn't warm, but he sounded like he meant the words.
The ramp seated on the outrigger with the usual bang. The first two boats were nearing us. The third was close behind. The large lighter chugged clear of the cargo dock.
Stay here, Chief, till the locals tie up, I said. Colonel, you can come with me. I walked down the ramp, waving my left arm and smiling broadly. I was wearing ordinary spacer slops, but with a saucer hat. My belt purse was full of Alliance tollers. In my right cargo pocket was the pistol I'd gotten from Abram, the gun Monica had used to kill the Karst consul. I didn't like carrying it, but it would have been stupid not to. I stood at the end of the ramp.
We want all three of you, I called to the leading boats. I thought I recognized the boatman as the man who'd taken me and Georgios to land the day I was purchased. I held out my hand, slanted just enough that the locals could see the tollers in it, but not so much that the money slid into the water. I made a production of giving Folliot the coins and gestured him into the first boat, a battered metal one patched with structural plastic.
Stay here till we're all loaded, I ordered the boatman. I turned to the hatch and called, two more men,
until the lighter arrived. I didn't want to give the boatman a notion of how many of us there were. Folliot had managed to get into the first boat without displaying the submachine gun under his shawl. I knew that boatman would stay put now, but I really wanted troops in the others as well.
Two of Folliot's people trotted down the ramp, but Ellie Wochens was with them. I didn't object. Again, I openly gave money to the troops and pointed them to the boats. They weren't as careful as the colonel had been, but it didn't matter anymore. I walked out toward the stern of the outrigger and waved the lighter to me when its captain showed hesitation about tying up until the smaller boats had pulled away. I shouted toward the hatch, "Send the rest," and hopped directly into the lighter's bow, bumping the boy who held the line. I took it from him and lashed us to a cleat as Wochens crashed to the deck like a load of iron. She took a length of pipe from under her shawl as she headed for the stern. I hoped she knew she wouldn't need the club, but that was a minor problem if it was any problem at all. When his troops started to arrive, Folliot traded places with one of them and climbed back onto the ramp to take charge of sorting them out. The smaller boats turned toward shore with six men in each, as the remainder of the detachment filed onto the lighter. When the last one, Folliot himself, was aboard, I waved toward Wochens and loosed the line. I walked toward the stern as the diesel chugged, and we backed away from the outrigger. The boatman looked terrified as I approached. I reached into my purse, pulled out a handful of tollers. I didn't bother to count them. I pulled the throat of his tunic open and dumped the coins down it to catch at his belt.
Just do as you're told and stay quiet, I said, looking him in the eyes. There'll be more of these, understood?
By the time we'd returned to the pier, the smaller boats had grounded on the beach. Squads of six headed along shore toward either missile pit. They were walking briskly but weren't running. The remaining six accompanied the boatman to the shelter where the locals waited between runs.
Don't follow us in a mob, Folliot ordered as we headed up toward Salaam proper. Squads with 20 yards between each.
I heard a pop to my left and turned. A green flare floated down in the sky above the western missile battery. A moment later a similar flare popped over the battery to our right. The flares might puzzle locals, but I didn't think they'd alarm anybody. We had radios, but we'd only use them as a last resort. Neither Folliot nor I trusted radio in the thick walled town.
That's a relief, I muttered to Folliot as we snaked our way up the slope. To call any two streets parallel in a place like Salaam was stretching a point, but we were following the more or less continuous track to the right of the street at the center of the gully. I could generally touch the buildings on both sides by stretching my arms out.
Folliot snorted.
Even if the crews were awake, he said, and you said they wouldn't be, it wouldn't be a fight.
Not with the personnel and equipment I've seen on ships from Ben Yusuf.
I nodded, but what I'd said was true. I was relieved.
Most of the pedestrians we met were women out doing their shopping. The better off ones had a maid or two carrying purchases, and often an armed slave for a guard. I wouldn't have guaranteed that any of the guns I saw would function. One carbine was missing its loading tube, like the pistol we'd taken from Platt's chauffeur. I understood the colonel's contempt. He was more used to being shot at than I was, however. I heard the sound of a ship dropping toward the harbor, coming from the south as we had. I hoped it was one of the Saguntine sloops. They were supposed to follow us down when the Afraz announced that the missile batteries were in our hands. I could at least hope that was happening. We kinked to the right at the cross street, which led past the south flank of the palace, and then to the west toward the prison across the valley. Instead of doing that, I took Wochens into the alley behind the women's wing, while Foliot waited at the corner to guide his troops when the time came. Though it was high morning, the narrow passage was dim. Half a dozen men sheltered there. I didn't know what sort of transaction was going on. I took out more tallers as I approached. "You can come back when we've finished our business," I said, not shouting but loud enough to hear. I held the coins out in my left hand. "But you leave now, fast." Instead of giving the money to the nearest man, I tossed it over the heads of the whole group. The fellows closest to me had seen I was holding tallers, so they led the rush toward the other end of the alley. I signaled to Foliot to come through. Wochens went deeper into the alley with the pipe in her hand. A couple of the locals were taking longer than they should have to search for coins in the bad light. A swipe of the bludgeon across a man's backside sent him squealing with his fellows into the far street.
"It was just a tap, sir," Wochens said. "If I'd hit him like he deserved, I'd have broken his hips."
"I'm not so soft-hearted that I cared," I muttered. I tugged at the door. It resisted for a moment. There wasn't much likelihood that in the short time I'd been gone that Georgios or his successor had found somebody to engage the electronic lock through the console, but I was afraid that somebody'd drawn the bolt on the inside. Only rust had been fighting me. The door started to move. Wochens reached past and dragged it fully open so quickly that I had to jump out of the way. There was room in the tunnel for the whole Saguntine detachment. I stopped at the far end and waited till I heard the alley door clank shut. As I opened my mouth to speak, Colonel Foliot said, "Remember, men, we don't want to leave any survivors. Kill everyone you see." "No," I shouted, hoping to be heard over the general growl of agreement. "Sir, 3 weeks ago, that would have been Monica. I won't let you go any farther if you plan to massacre slaves and children." I couldn't really stop them. The only lock on the door was a little bolt on the top edge, but I had to say something. To Foliot, the palace was where his daughter had been imprisoned and raped. I assume he knew she had been raped. To me, and even I think to Monica, it had been home for several months. I have friends here. Foliot stared at me. Several of the troops had small lanterns which provided enough light for me to see his features distorted with anger, and for him to see the horror in mine. Foliot relaxed. "Yeah, you're right," he said quietly. He turned and roared, "Cancel that last order. If anybody resists, if anybody's got a weapon, shoot them." He faced me again. I gave him a rueful nod and pulled the door open. The palace staff hadn't even thrown the bolt since I'd escaped with Monica. We burst into the wives' garden. Two wives and half a dozen attendants were there. I deliberately set the assault for mid-morning. The palace was a maze at any time, and a night attack would be like charging into quicksand. A maid was coming out with glasses and a carafe of sherbet on a tray. She saw us and screamed. Dropping the tray, she turned to run back inside. Somebody shot from behind me. The maid slammed into the door jamb and slumped down. I hopped over her legs to get to the door from which she'd come. I'd provided as good a plan as I could of the interior of the building, but I'd never expected to be coming back, let alone to be coming back through the wives' wing. If we'd used the main entrance, we'd have been in a battle from the first instant. I didn't doubt that Foliot's troops could mow down huge numbers of the Admiral's soldiers, but there were hundreds of them, 1,000 being paid, but probably about 600 in reality. The places we wanted to get to were on the third and fourth floor. By entering the wives' wing, I was certain that we wouldn't meet serious armed opposition for maybe as much as an hour. Inside was a tiled lobby. The maid had come from the food preparation area to the left. It wasn't exactly a kitchen, but food which had been cooked in the main kitchen was passed through the flap in an iron-bound door to the women's side. Here it was separated and carried upward to the wives' apartment. The eunuch posted at the armored door had heard the scream and burst of shots in the garden. He was coming toward us, holding his impeller at the balance. Foliot gave him a short burst which flung his body into a preparation table. The cook who'd started to follow him screamed and threw herself to the floor. I was pretty sure she was unharmed. I was sorry about the maid outside, but that was just bad luck. The shooter, one of Foliot's men, probably regretted killing her too, but everybody was on edge. The dead eunuch was one of the pair who'd taken the loot from Monica so that Azul could break it. He died because he was carrying a gun, but I wouldn't have mourned him regardless. To the right was a circular metal staircase, which must have come out of a starship. I started upward with Wochens pounding along behind me. Another eunuch leaned over the fourth floor railing. Some people shot at him, blasting sparks of burning steel from the staircase. None of the shots hit the eunuch, but he dropped his carbine as he screamed and jumped back. That was just as good so far as I was concerned. There was no doorway on the second or third floors between the wives' section and the general palace, so there were no guards either. Another companionway had been mated to the unit which served the two lower floors. It was black enameled instead of stainless steel. So far as Wochens and I were concerned, the stairs were tedious but not a serious stretch of our abilities. Though older than I was, the bosun had spent her life since childhood climbing companionways and antennas. She'd still be going when I ran out of steam. The Saguntine contingent was well below us when we reached the top landing, though. They were reasonably fit, but spiraling up scores of steel treads was unusual exercise for any landsman. I was concentrating on each next step rather than looking up, which I suppose was a bad idea since somebody might look down at any moment and blow my head off. I wasn't used to thinking about that sort of thing. I didn't realize how high we'd gotten until I cut my left hand on the railing and realized that I'd reached where shots at the guard had gouged it. That eunuch had vanished. The only place it could have gone was into the wives' suites. I took the pistol out of the pocket where I'd let it ride throughout the assault. I didn't need to be running and jumping while waving a pistol I wasn't comfortable with. The door was light, an ordinary interior panel. I measured the distance, judging where to kick with my boot heel. Wochens brushed past. She smashed the door to flinders with her shoulder and continued on through. She tripped on the bottom portion of the doorframe and therefore buried her head in the stomach of the eunuch who'd been waiting inside with a leveled carbine. I stepped over the eunuch's flailing legs and rapped him on the skull with the butt of my pistol. We'd entered the wives' lounge. Furniture was overturned and various paraphernalia were scattered on the floor, cups, knitting, reading materials. The only person in sight was a maid who stood at the end of the corridor screaming her head off. Quite a lot of people were screaming. Since the doorways to the wives' rooms had curtains rather than solid panels, the voices didn't get much muffling. To my left was another iron-strapped door, the entrance to the admiral's private apartment. Beyond that would be a staircase down to the common part of the palace, but the door there was just as solid. I tried to jerk it open, but it didn't budge. The troops had brought a shaped charge in case we'd had to blow open the alley door. I knew where the draw bolt was and could have placed the explosive to chop it out of its hasp. I ran to the stairs to shout for somebody to bring it up soonest. Folliot, he was the third man, and his people had reached the top. "Bring the explosives," I shouted. "Stay clear," Wochens wheezed. I spun to look back at her, holding on edge the great marble-topped table from the lounge. The bosun stepped forward and smashed it into the center of the armored door. The stone broke into three great shards, plus a spray of dust and gravel, and the door burst inward. Wochens sat down in the rubble that she'd created, looking stunned. Even for her strength, that table must have been close to an overload. Two Saguntines charged into the admiral's apartments before I could get there. I heard shots, then a long burst from a submachine gun. The colonel and I ran in behind his men. One of the troops was clutching his bleeding left arm with his right hand. The air was sharp with ozone from the submachine gun, and gray with plaster dust blasted from the ceiling and far wall. On the vast circular bed lay the wounded admiral, trying desperately to raise his pistol for another shot. Azul sprawled across his legs. At least three slugs had hit her in the face as she tried to shield her master. The wounded soldier had dropped his submachine gun. The other man was trying to load a fresh tube into the weapon he'd emptied by locking on the trigger. Folliot stepped past them, aimed, and put a short burst into the base of the admiral's throat. Folliot turned. I think it was a moment before he recognized me. "We've finished our business here," the colonel said. "Let's get back to the harbor and see how Leary's getting on there." For several minutes I'd been hearing explosions that rattled ornaments. I suspected that meant Captain Leary and the naval contingent were getting on quite well. Chapter 34. We went back down the stairs, gathering up the troops that Folliot had left behind at each stage. As I passed the second floor, I sneezed at the sharpness of ozone and saw that a swatch of plaster had fallen from the wall at the far corner, exposing the bare bricks. There were no additional bodies on the floor. If the shots had been unnecessary or even accidental, at least the only damage was to the palace decoration. The Saguntine troops had dropped their shawls when we entered the building. They carried their submachine guns openly, ready for trouble. I just hoped they weren't going to provoke it. Several thousand people lived in Salaam, and a lot of them had a gun of some sort. The locals weren't organized, and wouldn't have been even if the Admiral were alive. But they could overwhelm the 40-some of us if they simply got the notion to try. The wives' garden was empty except for the men on guard. The maid's body had been dragged to where it wouldn't be further stepped on. Not that she cared anymore. At the far end of the passage, a grizzled non-com checked the troops off as they entered the alley. He looked startled at me and Wochens, but Folliot called, "There's four more after me, Gridley." We went back to the harbor in a ragged line. I heard several shots while we strode along as briskly as the pavement allowed. Because the path through the buildings was so irregular, we didn't look like an army. I doubt that more than half a dozen of us were visible at any one time. That shooting could have been anything. At any rate, there were no signs of it being aimed in our direction. When I came in sight of the water, a column of water shot up from the port outrigger of one of the pirate cutters out in the bay. I heard a shudder through my boots a moment before the bang of the explosion arrived through the air. The blast lifted the outrigger. The cutter rocked upward, then rolled onto its port side as the torn metal no longer supported it. The hull continued to fill slowly as it sank. The starboard outrigger wouldn't be enough to support the whole ship, but it would settle to the bottom on its side. I didn't see any civilians on the waterfront. Not only was there no one under Etzel's marquee, he'd drawn a grating over the front of the shop proper. Other businesses facing the harbor were closed and often shuttered. One of the cutters I'd noticed when we landed was in water so shallow that about half the hull was still visible. Others must have sunk out of sight, but there were three sloops from Saguntum's Naval Protection Force that had arrived. They weren't much bigger than the pirate cutters, but each was built around a single anti-ship missile similar to those in the defensive batteries here and in most harbors. Their chemical fuel made them short-range weapons, with nothing like the impact of a warship's missiles at interplanetary distances. They accelerated much more quickly than high-drive motors could move the 5-ton warship projectiles, however. Pirate cutters carried bombardment rockets to strip their rigging from prey and threaten the hulls, but not to do serious damage to the ships they were trying to capture. These sloops were armed to gut pirates and kill everyone aboard. There was a fourth sloop in orbit for protection, but these had landed when the Alfraz had captured the port defenses. A large inflatable boat was making for the shore. Others were in the harbor around the remaining pirate cutters. The inflatable ran up on the shore near the local craft. Colonel Folliot carried his submachine gun slung right side up under his arm with his hand on the grip, a patrol sling. He called, "We got the bastard, Leary, and you seem to be doing well yourself." The last pirate cutter in harbor spouted water from the side, then dipped and began to fill. An inflatable boat like Captain Leary's had already left the pirate and was heading to shore, as were the two others in the harbor. "It's been a very satisfactory morning," Leary said, hopping out of the boat. Hogg remained seated in the bow, his stocked impeller pointed skyward. His eyes scanned the buildings on the harbor side, reminding me of a bird of prey on its perch. The coxswain and the other five armed passengers were in Saguntine battle dress. "Olfetri," the captain said, "all the sissies and I will return to Saguntum with you and the Alfraz. Colonel, you'll load your people into the sloops like we'd planned. And we've got plenty of room," he nodded to the west, where a line of ragged people were staggering to the shore on the other side of the town. Prisoners released from the slave pen. They were guarded by troops in battle dress. "For the freed slaves. We've brought along hammocks if there's too many for the couches already in the hold." "Sir," I said, "will you be taking command of the Alfraz?" "Goodness no, Olfetri," the captain said with a broad grin. "She's your ship, and as far as I can tell, you've been handling her quite well." Inflatable boats would carry about 30 people apiece, but the line on the other side of the swale continued to come. The Saguntines who cleared that missile pit must have gone straight to the prison instead of waiting for support from the sloops as planned. Because they'd had more time, the troops had knocked in doors and taken any slaves who'd wanted to come. That had worked out all right. They hadn't started a full-scale battle while deep into a hostile city. I didn't like thinking about it, though. It was like somebody telling me I needn't bother with the safety line and the rigging. Most times that was true, but why take a risk when there wasn't any reason for it? "Wochens," I said, "go head the freed slaves over to the lighter we came to shore with. I'll get the crew aboard and ready for you." It occurred to me as I trotted off to the boatman's shelter that maybe I should have checked with Captain Leary, but it was the obvious thing to do. The lighter would carry the best part of 100 passengers. That was better than shuttling them in inflatables. The troops guarding the boatmen looked glum about missing the action, but their prisoners were sitting on their haunches, chatting and brewing coffee, much as they would have been if we hadn't arrived on Ben Yusuf. I recognized the lighter's owner and his boy. We had the motor running by the time Wochens arrived with the head of the line of freed prisoners. 30 or 40